Good morning. It's Monday, the 22nd of April, and this is Govinda Ajaythiraj broadcasting and streaming from Mumbai, India's financial capital. Our top stories and themes for the day: the stock markets and oil recover from Middle East tensions. All eyes are back on earnings. Indian IT industry's falling headcounts, what they really mean and why the prognosis is grim. What exactly is going on with Elon Musk's India investment? Connecting a few dots. Insurance companies will now offer health coverage for pre-existing conditions like cancer as well. Also, age limit of 65 years removed. Why a policy to offer free bus rides to women may not have the desired effect.
This is a Core Report with Govindraj Ethiraj.
Markets recover from Middle East tensions, as does oil, in a brighter outlook for the week ahead. So the good news is that Friday saw the markets pull back after falling steadily for most of the week. The immediate triggers were the Iran-Israel conflict, which looked and perhaps still does all set to become something bigger. A minute or two on this important subject. As expected, at least on the Core Report, Israel retaliated on Friday against Iran's firing of some 200 missiles into Israel, which in turn was a retaliation for Israel bombing Iran's consulate in Syria. Israel fired into some Iranian cities, but Iranian media itself showed visuals suggesting all was quiet. The Associated Press reported authorities saying that air defenses fired at a major base near Isfahan, which long has been home to Iran's fleet of American-made F-14 Tomcats. Isfahan is also home to sites associated with Iran's nuclear program, including the underground Natanz enrichment site, which has been repeatedly targeted by suspected Israeli sabotage attacks. Now, state television described all Iranian atomic sites in the areas as fully safe, and the International Atomic Energy Agency also said that there was no damage to Iran's nuclear sites. Iranian officials made no mention of possible Israeli involvement, and Israel also had no comment on the apparent attack except some one hardline government minister making a statement. So the backroom lobbying, and this is the important part, and pressure building is evidently quite intense because both sides in some ways have downplayed their actions and promised, at least on the back channel, not to push things further as it appears now, since the hawks itching for war were seemingly placated, at least for now. What that means is that oil prices have fallen quite sharply, and more on that shortly. So the key trends to watch in Indian stock markets, if there are no flare-ups elsewhere, will be earnings and flows. There are expectedly no surprises on earnings for both HDFC Bank and Wipro, among others, both of which reported muted results. HDFC Bank reported 2% growth in consolidated net profit to 17,600 crores for March 2024. Wipro's results edged past low revenue expectations in the fourth quarter on Friday thanks to a pickup in its consulting business, and its consolidated revenue fell about 4% to roughly $2.6 billion for the quarter, but that was ahead of analyst estimate according to Reuters. Overall, the BSE Sensex declined about 1,156 points or about 1.5%, and the Nifty fell about 372 points or 1.6% last week. Money Control said that some 160 companies will release quarterly earnings this week, including companies like Reliance, Tata Consumer, Axis, Hindustan Unilever, Bajaj Finance, HCL Tech, Maruti Suzuki, and ICICI Bank. There are many more earnings, and now, of course, earnings come fairly bunched up. And in most cases, the companies are fairly closely tracked, so surprises in any direction are likely to be minor. So the worrying factor is that foreign institutional investors are continuing to sell India. They sold about almost 12,000 crores worth of stocks in the cash segment last week, taking the total monthly outflow to about 22,000 crores so far in April. The buying is coming, like before, from the domestic institutions. While high interest rates in the US are pulling back funds, the trend reversal is noteworthy because the buying had only begun picking up in recent months. Bloomberg reported last week that global funds are retreating from emerging markets in Asia, with a five-month buying spree of stocks ending on scaled-down expectations for US rate cuts. This excluded China and also snaps the longest streak of purchases going back to 2017. And oil prices are down again. Oil prices seem to be responding quite swiftly to risk sentiment shifts, notably in the Middle East now. Or another way of looking at it is the demand signals are so low that prices drop the moment the risk perception eases. Bloomberg reported an analyst from Rystad Energy saying their analysis suggests a fair market value of $83 per barrel based on fundamentals indicating a current premium attributable to geopolitical concerns. So Brent crude was quoting at about $87.29 a barrel over the weekend, and in context has rallied about 13% this year thanks to increasing hostilities and tensions in the Middle East, as well as OPEC plus supply cuts, that's Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, supply cuts that have tightened the market. China continues to buy up gold. You can, for what it's worth, blame China for gold prices going where they are. We've of course been discussing how China is steadily buying up gold and contributing to gold's prices going to all-time highs above $2,400 an ounce this year. But there are some other interesting things about China and gold you may not have noticed. For one, China is still the world's biggest producer and consumer of gold. Second, it's not just China's central bank which is buying gold, but also retail shoppers, fund investors, and futures traders. The reason, very broadly, of course, is uncertain times and a move away from the dollar, particularly for the central bank. The interesting thing is that China and India are usually competing for the title of the world's largest buyer. But last year, as Bloomberg reports, China's gold jewelry demand rose 10%, while India's fell 6%. Moreover, in the last 2 years, China's overseas purchases totaled about 2,800 tons, more than all the metal that backs exchange-traded funds around the world, or about a third of stockpiles held by the US Federal Reserve, according to Bloomberg. And it shows no signs of slowing down. In the first 2 months of 2024, gold imports in China were 53% higher than they were in 2023. And the People's Bank of China, that's China's central bank, has been on a buying spree for 17 straight months, its longest ever run of purchases. So what does all of this mean? Well, it means that prices are likely to remain steady to edge higher in coming months. Though within India, there seems to be a slackening of demand with prices in that 74,000 rupees per 10 gram range. The other thing is that while jewelry demand may slow a little, investment demand could be strong or pick up, which could come also via gold exchange traded funds and the like. Insurance Regulatory Authority removes the 65 years limit and a pre-existing condition limitation for health insurance. Now, this is welcome news to many of us with older parents or older people who've searched for but found it difficult to get insurance as age passes. India's insurance regulator has now removed the age limit of 65 years for individuals buying health insurance policies. Now, this is a significant move. Earlier, individuals could not get comprehensive coverage, particularly if you were in that age bracket. However, with the recent amendment, which is effective from April 1, anyone, regardless of age, is eligible to buy a new health insurance policy. Moreover, and this is also important, insurers have been mandated to offer health policies to individuals with pre-existing medical conditions of any kind and cannot refuse insurance just because someone has had cancer, heart or renal failure, or AIDS. Moreover, insurers can now collect premium payments, which would obviously be high in such cases, in installments for the convenience of policyholders. The regulatory authority, that's IRDA, also said that there is no limit on Ayush treatment coverage, which is treatments like Ayurveda, Yoga, Naturopathy, Yunani, Siddha, and Homeopathy, which will also receive coverage up to the sum insured without any cap. Policyholders with benefit-based policies can file multiple claims with various insurers while enhancing flexibility and options, it said, and there would be a specialized channel, particularly for claims of senior citizens. The Tesla mystery deepens. So the market for your key product is slowing down. Your share price is tanking. You have other problems, many self-created, of course, apart from the fact that you run 6 companies. So at a time like this, do you go and expand into a new, smaller market, albeit with longer-term potential, or first double down and fix the problem at hand? Until the weekend, it appeared that Elon Musk, who heads Tesla, was doing just that, getting set to announce new manufacturing investments in India, speculated by wire agencies like Reuters to be in the region of $2 to $3 billion, and not doing much to tackle the fire burning at home. And then Musk announced the postponement of this much hyped up and planned trip to India, where he was supposed to meet the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and he cited obligations at his Tesla company, saying he aimed to reschedule the visit for later this year. According to him, unfortunately, very heavy Tesla obligations require that the visit to India be delayed, but I do very much look forward to visiting later this year. So before I come to the India part, now let's look at what's been going on with Tesla. Tesla, as we've been pointing out for several months in the core report, has been losing ground. Now, to be fair, this may not just be Tesla's problem, but one of slowing down of EV adoption, particularly in developed markets. Tesla has already reported vehicle deliveries that have missed estimates by a wide margin. The stock has fallen more than 40% this year, and its value is down to less than $470 billion. Right now, Tesla is cutting prices elsewhere, something automakers usually do only if pushed against the wall. Tesla has now cut, over the weekend, prices of its models across China, Europe, and the United States amidst slumping sales and an inventory glut, according to Bloomberg. Moreover, it also slashed the price of its driver assistance software it calls FSD, or full self-driving, by a third to $8,000 in the United States, which used to cost $12,000. Why? Because the promise of a fully autonomous vehicle has long been key to Tesla's lofty valuation, says Bloomberg. A robo-taxi is apparently going to be unveiled on August 8th. Now, in India, going by all the faithfully reported reports, Tesla was going to launch a low-cost EV in India and would manufacture one soon. We were told the EV would cost around 20 lakh rupees. By the way, that announcement was also supposed to happen at the Vibrant Gujarat Summit in the second week of January 2024. So this is actually the second time that Musk has ditched, though the first one was never finalized and was more in the nature of selective leaks and rumors. Back to now, Musk was expected to announce an investment of $2 to $3 billion to build a factory in India after the government announced a policy lowering high tariffs on imported cars if companies invest locally. This part was reported by Reuters. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. On April 6th, Reuters reported that Tesla had now junked plans to make low-cost EVs because of fierce competition from Chinese EV companies who are pricing below $10,000 a car. That report was kind of denied by Musk, but without any specific references. Moreover, a key Tesla official of Indian origin, Rohan Patel, who was a senior public policy and business development executive, has quit as of last week, along with another senior Tesla official. And interestingly, in 2023, it was Patel who led the talks with Government of India on setting up bays in the country and also spoke of, going by reports, a $24,000 EV car, which on the face of it is obviously less than 20 lakh rupees. Now, with Patel gone and Tesla's likely intent to scrap the cheaper EV, it is not clear to me what the India opportunity is, at least as far as EVs go. Of course, Tesla can and will still come in, first via cheaper imports, a policy concession it managed to wrangle against all odds, and then via local manufacturing, which is now mandated. But this could well be high-priced cars, thus competing with the electrics of the high-end BMWs, Audis, and Kias. Of course, there is a market there too, and Tesla might do well, but the numbers would be in the few thousands per year. Not something that's worth all this song and dance. And by the way, BMW is doing pretty well in EVs in the premium end, particularly in Europe, against the likes of Tesla. There is no reason it can't do the same in other markets like India. Meanwhile, I did wonder why Tesla is not going ahead with the $2 to $3 billion investment it's supposed to make, because Musk does not have to visit India for that. Shipment of cars can start in months, perhaps. Showrooms, going by Reuters again, are already being explored in Mumbai and Delhi, so things can start moving in earnest. Of course, that does not seem to be the case, at least for now. What does falling headcounts in Indian IT services companies mean? Last week, we touched upon how headcount in Indian IT services companies is falling consistently. The impact of this is a little broader, since this segment of youth employment is a key driver in consumption as well, both present and potential, as well as represents an aspirational side of the Indian economy. What are the signs looking like now? Before I come to that, let's take a look at some of the big companies. India's largest IT company, that's TCS or Tata Consultancy Services, reported a drop of about 13,000 employees to about 600,000 as of March 2024. Infosys said its headcount dropped by about 26,000 to 317,000. And Wipro too saw a headcount decline of about 24,500 on an annual basis. In total, the three leading IT companies saw a reduction of about 64,000 employees on an annual basis. So these numbers may seem small and perhaps are, but the trend reversal is significant. And this was the first time this has happened for Infosys and TCS. Now, if you look at revenue projections, which are in the region of 1% for Infosys and Wipro or lower, then it stands to reason that headcounts will keep dropping. If nothing else, because companies will try and protect margins. After all, the main cost is people. I reached out to Siddharth, or Sidpai, who has tracked India's IT services industry closely as a technology research consultant and is now founder and managing partner of Siana Capital, a venture firm. And I began by asking him why headcounts were falling and what it meant, more importantly, in the larger context.
When we look at the IT companies, I think there are a bunch of things that are happening. Shouldn't be a surprise, actually, to them. There are three or four things that are happening at the same time. Part of the reason why there is revenue flatlining is simply because there is a little bit of a hesitancy to spend in their traditional markets. And most of those who want to spend also at this point are actually looking to do cost takeout more than anything else. As a matter of fact, we saw in the print, Infosys is not meeting at least the street expectations. Part of the reason was given that, you know, there was a large financial services client that looked to restructure a contract and bring down what their spend was. That's not just for Infosys, it's germane across the industry. I think you find that clients are actually looking to bring down their spend at this point in time rather than increase it. So insofar as we have just code factories, which is what most of our Indian service providers are, for better or for worse, that type of work will be slowed down or even cut down as newer technologies come into play. So that's part of the reason why we are seeing this revenue slowdown. In fact, it's quite interesting to see that this wasn't something that they've prepared for well enough. If you look at some of their other counterparts, for example, Accenture, tired example, but nonetheless a valid one, they've managed to reposition and pivot themselves into new areas, especially marketing agencies, things like that, which none of the Indian service providers.
Right. And within the Indian service providers, so Accenture, as you mentioned, is a standout example. Do you feel that, is there a positioning challenge as well? I mean, is everyone's, let's say, skill or capability completely replaceable or substitutable?
Well, in certain parts of what they do, their skills are replaceable and substitutable. In fact, just to step back, I think there's something that we should understand about offshoring in general, regardless of which company is doing the offshoring, regardless of whether it's an Accenture using their Indian or Filipino centers for delivery, or whether it's an Indian company or IBM or whoever. Offshoring is a mezzanine step, typically, before there is automation of a particular function. So let me explain. If you were to look at BPO, for instance, the kinds of BPO, the back office non-voice BPO, which is being done where people are doing clerical tasks, like paying invoices, for instance, right? Typically meant they had to go somewhere in a particular screen, pull out a field, figure out how much the dollar amount was, and then approve it for payment based upon what 3 or 4-way checks. These things got automated long before GenAI came on the scene. There were companies like Automation Anywhere, Blue Prism, and others, which simply automated that function. So therefore, you did not need that clerk anymore who was sitting behind the screen to perform that function. So what's happened is that the BPO functions that are being provided from an outsourced perspective have simply been automated. It's part of a continuum. They go from being done by human beings in expensive geographies to the mezzanine step of being done by human beings in less expensive geographies to being obliterated or automated. So this is a normal continuum. The only question is, how long is the mezzanine step and how long do people stay on the mezzanine? Therefore, you will find that across various functions, there's a relentless drive to automate or bring in GenAI or whatever else you may have as tools to move forward and to automate it. So it's happened in BPO. We're now beginning to see it happen in IT. In fact, most outsourcers, whether they're Indian or not, should have seen this coming, because already there was reusable code out there, what are called low-code and no-code platforms out there, which basically means you don't need a programmer, you don't need an army of programmers. You can get by with much less than you used to before. These are available because of open source. These are available because of libraries that have been available for a long time, that you just drag and drop into your code and it works as it's supposed to. Now, for GenAI to do that much more easily, even without a human being to drag and drop it into the appropriate spot, is a large threat, you know, for further automation of that function. So I think the industry is actually facing a watershed moment, which unfortunately, in my mind, is not bright unless they make some significant changes in the way they approach the market.
Right. So there are two maybe approaches to this. So one is, let's say, the stock markets, which can be quite ruthless because they're looking for growth, which they used to see, which they're not seeing, and therefore are obviously reducing their exposure to IT services companies and have been doing it for some time. The other approach is a more economic one, is to say that, okay, these companies employ millions of engineers, they create jobs, and even if they don't grow like the way they used to earlier, they will still remain, you know, a large employment engine, foreign exchange generator, and so on. So how would you see these two vantage points, if one can call it that?
The basics of that are eroding. We're beginning to see that erode. Let's take the stock market out of it for now. I think some years ago, most outsourcers realized, certainly the Indian ones realized, that what they were doing was actually running code factories. They realize the need to train people. They realize the need to bring on armies of people who are basically workers in a factory. In fact, I heard the term code factory from a luminary in the field about a decade ago, maybe slightly longer ago, when he was talking about how they had set up their own training center, which could house, I think at the time, 15,000 people. Historically gone to engineering colleges, brought in these youngsters, trained them to some level of suitability, and then sort of let them loose, right, onto their various projects. And that has been typically what they've been doing over the years. But I think that is a bit of risk. The company I was actually referring to sort of sideways over there, again, was Infosys, right? They built this large campus in Mysore. And the person I was referring to was Mohandas Pai, who's an old friend of mine. She has the same last name, but is not related, but is a good friend. And he had mentioned when, after being their CFO, he became the head of their HR, he had mentioned how they were changing into code factories, which is right for the time. There are a couple of things that have happened. If you look at Infosys themselves, last year they hired 50,000 people from engineering campuses. This year it's zero. If you look at all the companies overall, they're actually beginning to shed the workforce. Now, the reason that's happening is a combination of factors. One is they don't need as many people as before, and so therefore they're not going out and hiring youngsters, newly minted engineers. The second thing that's also happening is that they were a little short-sighted during the COVID spike. When there was a lot of work being done remotely, people sitting in the US or the UK were thinking, well, if it can be done remotely in the US, then why can't it be done in India? And let's hire people in India to make this happen, or an outside geography. So there was this huge spike in the amount of work that actually got offshored as a result of that. Again, a mezzanine. But nonetheless, there was a spike because there was more reason to offshore, because there was proof that this work could be done remotely already. So therefore, why not do it out of India? And in that sort of melee, they went about hiring each other's resources sometimes at twice what they were making at their competition. Now, that's an unsustainable model. You know, anything that's too good to be true is too good to be true. If somebody was to tell me tomorrow that they're going to pay me 2x of what I'm making today, I will view it with a lot of suspicion. Unfortunately, you know, when I was younger, I might not have. A lot of youngsters, I think, have gotten pulled into that, and they've become part of this bloat, which now, of course, the IT companies need to shed if they need to keep themselves going. So I don't think it's a great story for youngsters coming out of campuses. You know, tangentially, look at the news. You know, we've got, I don't know what the number was, 15 or 20% of IIT graduates this year are not being hired. We've got some similar problems at IIM. These are the top institutes of the country. So you can then imagine what it's like in the lower echelons. One point, I think NASSCOM said that only about 26 or 27% of engineers were actually hireable or employable. That's sort of drastic. But if you actually look at the numbers, Statista, for instance, reported that only 50% of India's engineers are being hired, which is frightening. So you send your child off for an engineering education and there's only 1 in 2 chance of him or her being hired. It's not a great statistic. I would strongly suggest that people not make their children engineers and other careers to look at this point in time.
So, you know, a lot of young engineers or engineers, for instance, are also working with global capability centers or GCCs. You know, these are offshoots of large multinationals, mostly in the West. And these are not so visible. The people who go and work there, the work that's going on, because it's all feeding into the mothership. So is that something that can counterbalance some of the, you know, workforce opportunities and so on?
To some degree, but again, there as much a part of this mezzanine step that I spoke about, which is relocating the work to a cheaper geography. It's the same basic economic principle that's in play when a GCC is set up in India. Obviously, we like to dress it up, call it capability centers, call it quality centers, those sorts of things. But the primary driver is cost. There you make a big build versus buy decision. Do I build my own GCC or do I buy from an outsourcing firm? The economics make more sense for you to actually build it, or because the kind of work that you're doing is something that you want to keep closer in-house. Those are reasons for you to have a GCC. The mezzanine step of offshore doesn't go away there either. That same sort of caveat applies to GCCs as well. In fact, I don't think the GCCs are being open. Obviously, we don't have any view into what their numbers look like. But if you were to look at the overall placement figures, like I just referenced a little while ago about from the IITs, I think that's a sort of lagging statistic or what the entire sort of employment pool is looking like. I don't think the GCCs are going to counterbalance. I think we will see the GCCs also dropping people as we go forward, especially if there's more automation.
Sid, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Why free bus rides for women may not have the desired effect. A move to introduce discounted or free rides for women in buses in many states in India has been welcomed and celebrated even. But do they work? The reasons why they do and they do not have to do with a larger understanding of how economics works, particularly at a macro level, and why there is a give for every take. Economics journalist and author Pooja Mehra kicks off a new show on The Core Report called How India's Economy Works, where she delves into issues around India's economic policies with the people who shape them. Tune in for the first episode with Dr. Haseeb Drabu, economist and former finance minister of Jammu and Kashmir, and of course the many to follow. You'll find Pooja's episodes on Apple, Spotify and YouTube, among others. And of course, stay tuned to The Core Report for updates on all of them.
So what I wanted to say is that, you know, not just Indian economy, but any economy, these are few things I feel that people must always understand, even if they don't have an interest in economics, because it affects their everyday life. And somehow we don't fully grasp these things. It becomes more important in the case of India because of some, you know, peculiar characteristics of the economy, of the politics, of government, etc. So one thing I think that everybody must understand is that there has to be a matching of policy objectives with the policy design. And that doesn't often happen in India. So for instance, let me give you the example of the pink slip scheme that many states have rolled out, where women get to ride for free on public bus services, and the state government reimburses the bus operators for these rides. They become very popular. A lot of women, the ridership of women has increased in many states on bus services, and that's a very good outcome. Agreed. If it becomes easy for women to commute, that's a good outcome. However, if the objective was to ensure that women's participation in the labor force, that is, for more and more women to get into jobs and work, paid work, if that was the objective, then there's just recently a World Bank study that has come out that has done surveys, etc., that shows that that's not happening. And in fact, in some places, such as in Delhi, it may have actually led to women working less, you know. So understanding of basic economics of, you know, these things is very important. And I'll tell you how it happens. So women that were earlier doing, for instance, if for instance in the family, it was the father who was dropping the kids to school, that burden of unpaid work has now shifted to women because they get to do these bus rides for free. They have less time to do paid work, to do jobs, and their burden of the housework has actually increased. So what the findings of the economists who have studied this is that it's not just enough for you to ensure that women are able to commute easily and conveniently and for less to increase their participation in the labor force. It actually needs a whole lot of other interventions, and such as, you know, in India's case, some cultural issues have to be resolved, certain other things need to fall into place. In France, etc., just the commute itself, you know, is enough to ensure there's more women's participation. So if you find that a government is giving somebody a tax benefit, or if they're giving something for free food, you know, the constituency that is getting it is surely benefiting, but there's always going to be a loser, you know, because if they're giving it to somebody, they're taking it away from somebody else because the pie is fixed. It's only increasing at a certain rate, right? It's very important to understand who's losing and on the net, who overall is the economy gaining or losing. So if Apple is getting money to make iPhones, who is that money being taken away from to give it to them? That's very important to understand. And mostly it is economists who are able to do these kind of analysis. Engineers, bureaucrats, politicians can build great narratives. They're not able to do these kind of estimations. And that's why I feel it's important to talk to economists about these things.
What are the kind of people that you will be talking to? And what are the kind of insights that you will be bringing out or be hoping to bring out? One or two examples.
So I'm talking mostly to people who are in the thick of these things, either somebody who's been a policymaker themselves and therefore have insights to share on how they worked with a certain problem and produced results or failed to produce results. For instance, I'm going to be talking to somebody who has worked in the revenue department of the government, specifically customs, where there has been tremendous success in reducing the time taken on ports, airports, as well as seaports, for shipments to both be released for imports as well as exports, but especially for exports. And there's a drastic improvement India has shown in the last few years. So so we'll find out how it was done, why it is important, how that leads to improved business, things like that. We've already done one episode which is already out on Kashmir's economy and why it's important to understand that some of the assumptions that we make about a particular economy, a particular community, a particular business group, actually, the reality can be, very, very different. So that episode is already out.
Looking forward to this and much more. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
That was The Core Report with me, Govindraj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.